Mark did not recognize it for a moment, but when he did, he was startled. "I did not know you read the book," he exclaimed, and Sean glanced up at him from under beetling brows. "I read it," he said gruffly. "The older I get, the more I read it. There is a lot of solace here."
But, sir," Mark persisted, "you never go to church."
This time Sean frowned as though he resented the prying questions. "I live my religion," he said. "I don't go singing about it on Sunday and drop it for the rest of the week, like some I know." His tone was final, forbidding further discussion, and he turned his attention to the battered volume. He had marked his place with a pressed wild flower, and the Bible fell open at the right page.
"I found it last night," he told Mark, as he propped the steel-rimmed spectacles on his nose. "It seemed like an omen, and I marked it to read to you. Matthew chapter 10.
He cleared his throat and read slowly.
"Are not two sparrows sold for a farthing? And one of them shall not fall on the ground without your father."
When he had finished, he tucked the Bible away in his pocket, and they were both silent, thinking about it, and watching the shapes in the ashes of the fire.
"Then perhaps he will help us to save the sparrow from its fall here at Sharker's Gate," said Sean, and he leaned forward to take a burning twig from the fire.
He lit a fresh cigar with it and puffed deeply, savouring the taste of wood smoke and tobacco, before speaking again.
"It is just unfortunate that it all comes at a time like this. It will be the end of next year before we can make an official move to have the proclamation ratified and budget for full development here."
Mark was instantly alert, and his voice sharp as he demanded,
"Next year?
I'm afraid so."
"But why so long?"
"That's the grim reality of politics, son," Sean growled. "We've just received a shattering blow, and all else must wait while we play the game of power."
"What's happened?" Mark asked with real concern now. "I haven't read a newspaper in 2 months."
"I wish I were that lucky," Sean smiled without humour. "Oh, there was a by-election in a little place up in the Transvaal. It's a seat that has always been ours, a good safe seat, in the hands of a respected backbencher of great loyalty and little intellect. He had a heart attack in the dining room of the house, expiring between the soup and the fish. We went to our safe little constituency to elect a new member."
Here Sean paused, and his expression went bleak.
"And we got the trouncing of our lives. A 15% swing to the Herzog party. They fought us on our handling of the strike last year, and it was a disaster."
"I didn't know. I'm sorry."
"If that swing, 15%, carries for the whole country, then we will be in opposition after the next election. Everything else is of no significance. General Smuts has decided to go to the country next year in March, and we will be fighting for our existence. Until then, we cannot introduce this type of legislation or ask for funds."
Mark felt cold despair spread out to numb his very fingertips. "What happens here?" he asked. "In the meantime, must we stop what I am doing? Do we just leave it? Another year of poaching and hunting? Another year without protection or development?"
Sean shook his head. "I've had my people studying the existing proclamation. We have powers there that we can enforce, but no money to do it."
"Ugh, you can't do anything without money," said Mark miserably.
"Ah, so at last a little respect for the power of money." Sean shot him a thin smile across the fire, and then went on seriously. "I've decided to finance the development and running of the proclaimed area until I get a budget allocation for it. I'll foot the bill from my own pocket. Perhaps I'll get reimbursed from the budget later, but if I don't," he shrugged, "I reckon I owe that much at least. I've had a pretty good run."
"It won't need much," Mark rushed in eagerly, but Sean quieted him irritably.
"You'll get the same salary as before, and we'll make a start in the main camp. I'm going to give you 4 men to do the work," he went on, speaking quietly. "We'll have to make do without a bridge across the river, and only a wagon track for our first road, but it'll be a start, and let's just hope like hell we win our election."
On the last day, at breakfast, Sean laid a folder in front of Mark.
"I talked Caldwell, the man who did the drawings for Jock of the Bushveld, into designing the layout."
He smiled as Mark opened the folder. I wanted you to get the best for your £3,000. In the folder was a mock-up of the full-page press announcement which would launch the Friends of African Wildlife. The margin contained magnificent line drawings of wild animals, and under the heavy typed announcement was set out the objects of the society and an eloquent plea for support and membership. I and my lawyers draft the articles and draw up the wording. We'll run it in every newspaper in the country. The society's address is the head office of Courtney Holdings, and I have taken on a full-time clerk to handle all the paperwork. I've also got a young journalist to edit the society's newspaper. He's full of ideas and caught up in the whole thing. With luck, we'll get huge public support behind us. It's going to cost more than £3,000. Mark was torn between delight and concern for the size to which his simple idea had grown. Yes, Sean laughed. It's going to cost more than £3,000, which reminds me, I've sent Dirk Courtney a receipt for his money and a life membership of the society. The joke carried them over the awkwardness of the last moments before departure. Sean's bearers disappeared among the trees, carrying headloads of equipment to where the motor lorry had been left on the nearest road, 20 miles beyond the cliffs of Sharker's Gate, and Sean lingered regretfully. I'm sad to go, he admitted. It's been a good time, but I feel stronger now, ready to face whatever the bastards have got to throw at me. He looked about him, taking farewell of river and mountain and wilderness. There's magic here, he nodded. Look after it well, son. And he held out his hand. It was Mark's last opportunity to ask the question which he had tried to ask a dozen times already, but each time Sean had turned it aside or simply ignored it. But now he had to have an answer, and he took Sean's big, gnarled, bony fist in a grip that would not be denied. You haven't told me how Storm is, sir. How is she? Is she well? How is her painting? He blurted. It seemed even then that Sean would not be drawn. He stiffened angrily, made as if to pull his hand away, and then the anger faded before it reached his eyes. For a moment there showed in the deep-set eyes a dark, unfathomable grief. And his grip tightened on Mark's hand like a steel trap. Storm was married a month ago, but I've not seen her since you left Lion Kop, he said. And he dropped Mark's hand. Without another word, he turned and walked away. For the first time, he went slowly and heavily, swaying against the drag of his bad leg, shuffling like an old man. A very tired old man. Mark wanted to run after him, but his own heart was breaking, and his legs would not carry him. He stood forlornly and watched Sean Courtney limp away into the trees. The Natal number 2 came in along the line, his pony's hooves kicking up little spurts of white marking lime, like a machine gun traversing, and he caught the ball 2 feet before it dribbled out of play. He leaned low out of the saddle and took it backhanded under his pony's neck, a full-blooded stroke that finished with the mallet high above his head, and the ball rose in a floating arc, a white blur against the stark blue of summer sky. From the clubhouse veranda and the deck chairs beneath the coloured umbrellas, applause splattered above the drum of hooves, and then rose into a swelling hum as they saw that Derek Hunt had anticipated. He was coming down in a hard canter, with Saladin not yet asked to extend. Saladin was a big pony, with a mean and ugly head that he cocked to watch the flight of the white ball, his overlarge nostrils flaring so the shiny red mucous membrane flashed like a flag. The eye that watched the ball rolled in the gaunt skull, giving the horse a wild and half-crazed air. He was of that raggedy roan and grey that no amount of currying would ever brighten into a gloss, and his hooves looked like those of a cart-horse. He had to lift them high in the ungainly action that was quickly carrying him ahead of the hard-running Argentinian pony at his shoulder. Derek sat him as though he were an armchair, idly penduluming his stick from his wrist, his pith helmet hard down over his ears and strapped up tightly under the chin. His belly bulged out over the belt of his breeches. His arms were long and thick as those of a chimpanzee, covered with a thick fuzz of ginger hair. The skin was heavily freckled, and had a raw red look between the freckles, as though he had been scalded with boiling water. His face was the same raw, painful-looking red, tinged by the purplish glaze of the very heavy drinker, and he was sweating. The sweat glistened like early dew on his face and dripped from his chin. His short-sleeved cotton singlet looked as though he had been caught in a tropical downpour. It clung to the thick, bear-like shoulders and was stretched so tightly over his bulging paunch and so transparent with wetness that you could see the deep, dark pit of his belly button from the sidelines. At each jar, as Saladin's hooves struck the hard-baked earth, Derek Hunt's great backside in the tight-fitting white breeches quivered like a jelly in the saddle. Two Argentinian ponies were cutting across the field to cover, their handsome riders, olive-skinned and dashing as cavalry officers, riding with huge verve and excited Spanish cries, and Derek grinned under his bristling ginger moustache as the ball started its long plummeting curve back to earth.
"Christ!" drawled one of the members of the clubhouse steps. "The ugliest horse in Christendom!"
And he raised his pink gin to salute Saladin. "And the ugliest four-girl handicapper in the entire world on his back," agreed the masher beside him. "Poor bloody dagos should turn to stone just looking at them." Saladin and the Argentinian number one arrived at the drop of the ball at exactly the same moment. The Argentinian rose in the saddle to trap the fall, his white teeth sparkling under the trim black pencil line of his moustache, the smooth, darkly tanned muscles of his arm bulging as he prepared to go on to the forehand drive. His sleekly beautiful pony, wheeling into line for the shot, nimble and quick as a ferret. Then an extraordinary thing happened. Derek Hunt sat fat-gutted and heavy in the saddle, and nobody could see the touch of rein and heel that made Saladin switch his quarters. The Argentinian pony cannoned off him as though she had hit a granite copy, and the rider went over her head, going in an instant from balanced perfection to sprawling, windmilling confusion, falling heavily in a cloud of red dust, and rolling to his knees to scream hysterical protest to the umpire and the skies. Derek leaned slightly, and there was the tap of mallet against bamboo root, a gentle, almost self-effacing little tap, and the ball dropped meekly ahead of Saladin's slugging, hammering head. It bounced once, twice, and then came up obediently for the next light tap that kept it hopping down the field. The Argentinian number four swept in from the right with all the smooth-running grace of a charging lioness, and the roar of the crowd carried across the open field, spurring him on to make the challenge. He shouted a wild Spanish oath, his eyes flashing with excitement. Smoothly, Derek changed the mallet from his right hand to his left and tapped the bouncing white ball onto his offside, forcing the Argentinian to increase the angle of his interception. The instant he was drawn, Derek cropped hard, lofting the ball in an easy lob high over the Argentinian's head. He said, "Ha!" but not loudly, and touched Saladin with his heels. The big ugly roan stretched out his neck and extended, with Derek moving now to help him push. They ran past the Argentinian as though he had indeed turned to stone. They left him floundering in their wake and picked up the ball beyond him. Tap, tap, and tap again. He ran it down through the exact centre of the stubby goalposts and then turned and trotted back to the pony lines. Chuckling so that his belly bounced, Derek swung one leg forward over Saladin's neck and slid down to the ground, letting him go free to the grooms. "I'll take Satan for the next chucker," he shouted in that beery, throaty voice. Storm Courtney saw him coming and knew what was going to happen. She tried to rise, but she was slow and clumsy. The child in her womb anchored her like a stone. "One for the poor, what?" shouted Derek, and caught her with one long, ginger-fuzzed, boiled red arm. The sweat on his face was icy cold and smeared down her own cheek, and he smelled of sour beer and horse. He kissed her with an open mouth in front of Irene Luchard's and the four other girls and their husbands and all the grinning grooms and the members on the veranda. She thought desperately that she was going to be ill. The acid vomit rose in her throat, and she thought she was going to throw up in front of them all. "Derek, my condition," she whispered desperately. But he held her under his one arm as he took the bottle of beer that one of the white-jacketed club servants brought on a silver tray, and scorning the glass, he drank straight from the bottle. She struggled to be free, but he held her easily with immense and careless strength, and he belched, a ripping explosion of gas.
"One for the poor!"
he shouted again, and they all laughed, like courtiers at the king's jest.
"Good old Derek! Law unto himself, old Derek!"
He dropped the empty bottle. "Keep it until I get back, wifey," he laughed, and took one of her swollen breasts in his huge, raw-knuckled, red-boiled hand and squeezed it painfully. She felt cold and trembly, and weak with humiliation and hatred.